podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. We've got an England squad with a couple of new faces in it to talk about this morning. Sandpapergate is back in the news. There's been another rain-affected round in the Championship and there's a new Wisden Cricket Monthly out this week. I'm Yaz Rana and today I'm joined by Wisden Cricket Monthly Editor-in-Chief Phil Walker, Wisden Cricket Monthly Magazine Editor Joe Harmon and former England batsman Mark Butcher. First off, we've got our first test squad of the summer. I think there were a grand total of zero surprises in it, pretty much as we've predicted over the last month or so. Ollie Robinson and James Bracey, who have both spent much of the last year in various bubbles with the test group, are the only uncapped players in the 15-man squad. There's a recall for Craig Overton, and every fit player who played in the IPL has been rested. Butch, I'll go to you first, because you talked about the possibility of the IPL lot not playing on last week's show. The press release that accompanied the squad announcement read, multi-format players Moeen Ali, Johnny Bairstow, Joss Butler, Sam Curran and Chris Wokes are rested after completing a quarantine period following the cancellation of the IPL earlier this month. They will spend some time resting before joining up with their respective counties in due course. What do you reckon?
Well, I think it's a bit of a red herring to sort of talk about the quarantine period at the back end, because the IPL wouldn't be finished yet. And therefore, what that tells me is that there was never any chance that those guys would play. You know, the chances are they would have had to have had quarantine at the back end if they got through to the playoffs anyway. And so, to me, the intention was that those guys were never seriously being considered to play. Which, again, is understandable for lots of reasons, but it also sort of begs the question, are certain test series now being rated as second class? And what does that say for the international game? What does that say for the value of a test cap? All of which I have a big issue with.
Not just any series against the number one and two ranked sides in the world. England, at the end of this series, will be eight tests into their year. And arguably only for one of those tests have they been anywhere near full strength.
What do you want me to say to that?
What do you think can change about it? We've had quite a few questions about this. One of them from Kieran was, given that England are hosting two of the best test nations this summer, and this has been described as Ashes preparation by Silverwood, more can Test cricket do to add importance to non-Ashes games for England? The World Test Championship might be a start, but why not a World Cup? These are the number one and two ranked teams in the world.
Tongue from Chris Silverwood. He should never, ever have said that.
He said it a few times.
But it's not true, is it?
Well, the Ashes preparation?
Yeah.
It's in the press
test
release.
Test matches.
It was in the press release.
Well, okay, I'm telling you what I think. They're test matches. They count hugely. A lot of fans, for example, won't be going to the Ashes. In normal circumstances, a lot of fans won't be going to the Ashes. So the home test matches for England are the thing. So I that's nonsense. And look, you know, the IPL, as always, as it always has been, is a choice that players make to either go or not go. And yes, there are certain circumstances in which the boards will say, it's a damn good idea that some of our players go. And I'd always backed the Peterson view of the whole thing, that if you were going to, you know, if you take your white ball cricket particularly seriously, then you want to have a taste of the best tournament with the best players at some point in your career. However, if you're making that choice knowing that it's going to cost you test matches, then you're taking a very, very tricky path, a dodgy path, not only for the game itself, but also for your own career. And I have a problem with it. And I think that a lot of fans will have a problem with it too. And you have to understand that I'm not coming from this from the point of view that the IPL, you know, is a disgrace and it shouldn't be getting in the way. I love the IPL. I think it's brilliant. I think it's done extraordinary things for the game. However, individual players have individual choices to make about how the IPL impacts their bread and butter, which is playing international cricket for England.
So do you think that the England IPL players, so Chris Wokes, Sam Curran, Joss Butler, should have basically said, we want to play the series, I don't want to be rested?
I think they should be available, yes. And then it's up to the board as to whether or not they select them. But I can't, because it's very, very dangerous. It's an incredibly slippery slope. if you get to a point where whereby the calendar is as crowded as it is, and it and nothing seems to be ever done about that, it's just more and more and more and more cricket. And that if players now know that the that going forward, they will able be able to make the decision to play in tournaments elsewhere and put themselves out of contention to be selected for England Test matches, particularly home Test matches. I'm not happy.
I think it's worth just reading out what Chris Silverwood said, in not in the press conference, in the press release that accompanied the squad announcement. This is his second sentence in the press release. Playing the top two teams in the world in New Zealand and India is perfect preparation for us as we continue to improve and progress towards an Ashes series in Australia at the back end of the year. Phil or Joe, do you have anything to add to that?
I was just going to say that's not new. Silverwood's been saying this since he took the role, and I think he's done a really good job so far. But I do think this is a very dangerous game he's playing by constantly talking about this whole thing building towards the Ashes, which is a series that England might well lose. England could beat the two best sides in the Test rankings at home this summer. That would be great. They might still do it with a slightly weakened side, but to say this is all to do with the Ashes, I mean, that means if they win these two this summer but then lose the Ashes, in theory that they've failed in their mission, because this was all preparation for the Ashes. Deal with each series as its own thing. We've got two really exciting series against two high quality opposition. They are things in their own right that England should try and win. Then we can worry about the Ashes and who should go on that tour at the end of these series.
This has always been my argument about the idea that Test match cricket needs context in some way, right? The idea that a World Test Championship would suddenly make Test matches more interesting, more accessible, more exciting. They don't. Every Test match, to me as a player and as somebody who watches Test match cricket, every Test match is an individual event in its in and of itself. And therefore, these two series against New Zealand and India, not only are they the two best sides in the world, but they are seven individual events for which you would want, if you're an England fan, to see the very best team that England could put out on the field, defending the honour of England in Test match cricket. A record that they have at home is absolutely astonishing. You know, and going out there all guns blazing to win them. And as Joe says, they may very well win those two series, because England don't lose a Test match series at home. However, to talk about it in terms of it being some sort of net session for the Ashes is bizarre.
Yeah, and there's a lot in that, and it's been echoed by many others as well. I remember I interviewed Ponting about this years ago with regards to the World Test Championship, which was still, as ever, in gestation at the time. And he said the same thing as Butch, that a memorable Test match can spring up from nowhere, and it's a self-contained event in and of itself. And okay, there is a broader narrative to it if it's part of a series, of course. But if we can go back to certain great Test matches and not really remember the series score, but we remember those 5 days and the stories that evolved from there. So there is a lot in that. I would just add, and this is not to denigrate what's coming up in a couple of weeks' time at Lords, which will be a huge moment for the fans. Primarily. But the two tests against New Zealand are peculiar Test matches, because New Zealand are bringing a team over here and they will want to win those games and they'll want to compete in those games, but they have a huge game the following week. And from their point of view, it's probably the first time I can remember an occasion when a team will be coming over to England to play a Test match and their primary focus won't be playing England. It'll be playing another team in England the following week. Now, that's not in any way to kind of undercut your point, but and there is no justification for not picking your strongest side against India. And I said that 2 or 3 months ago, and that still sticks in the craw. And if we see any of this kind of jostling in a month's time, then that's disgraceful, of course.
Don't forget, we're the home team.
Sure.
You know, it's different. Sure. But the travelling sides, they can do what they want. You know, they can come over here and decide to go shopping in Knightsbridge for 2 months for all I care. It doesn't matter. What I care about is what the England team are.
Yeah, no, fair. From the ECB's perspective, the cat is out the bag, obviously, with the IPL. And they are now full square behind it, as are their kind of broadcasting rights holders and so on. The BBC now cover it, as well as Sky and so on. So they are the establishment position is now fully behind the IPL. And that obviously extends to the players. I'm not sure what they can do with regards to challenging the players to make that decision. I don't know. And I just don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is there. But now the ECB's position is, go and play, go and play. Johnny, go and play. Joss, go and play. Joffre, go and play. It's the greatest tournament in the world. When the calendar falls, as it often does, inconveniently for the ECB, I don't know what recourse they have. What can you say? Well, on the one hand, we want you to go and play, but on the other, if you do go and play and then it impinges on test match selection, then what, you're not available for the whole of that subsequent test series or what? It's very difficult.
But
we're
talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 first choice players.
Yeah. It's unprecedented for a home test match, the first home test match to be impacted by this thing. This is the first, but it will happen again. The first test match of a summer is later now than it's ever been. In as much as it comes out in June, the first test of a seven test summer. But normally it would be in May, which eats into the IPL even further. And it's only going to be a matter of time before the England players are in the final for Rajasthan or whoever it is. And an agreement will be reached.
But what used to happen would be that players would go and they were on the proviso that they would be back by a certain date because they get because they're preparing for the English summer. And there's not been a problem with that.
Yeah.
Now this time,
it wasn't
this time like they're not even playing. And I know, and again, don't at me with they've been in a bubble, they're not ready to go. I know that, but the facts of the matter are, even had the tournament not been postponed, they would still be there,
indeed,
and they wouldn't be playing. So at no point you might make this call now and say, it's because of the bubbles and all this kind of stuff. They were never going to be playing in this series.
Yeah.
This decision had been taken a long, long time ago, and I have a problem with that.
Yep, so do I.
I think it's quite interesting from an Australian point of view. Mitchell Starc's one of, if not the best, white ball bowler in the world. He's not playing the IPL for various reasons for a very, very long time. I almost think with Kevin Peat is an argument. You get to a certain level as a player where you don't need the IPL. If you've got IPL experience, do you actually need your very best players to play in the IPL? Going back to Kieran's question, what do you think can be done to give... place more importance on individual test matches?
Well, the obvious answer is the WTC, isn't it?
Mm.
Which has been stillborn for obvious reasons. These two test matches coming up against New Zealand are not part of it because New Zealand are preparing for the final of it. But then when it begins again and the cycle starts again from the start of the India series, points towards the next run, and then, hopefully, arguably, possibly spuriously, but we hope that it will inject a little bit more context to it. But the broader point about the overwhelming power of an Ashes series, well, we reap what we sow, because the hype around it for the last 20 years or so has, especially since 2005, has just been through the roof. And so much of sport now is content generation, and it is presenting something that feels like the be-all and end-all. It's appointment to view. You can't miss it. And as a consequence, the money is ramped up as well. And that has fed into, I think, the England players' psyche. I can't speak for Australian players, but certainly among England players. You know, Joe Metz said, well, Silverwood's, it's not the first time he said this stuff. Well, he's not alone either. When Root got the job, I was at the press conference when Root got the job, and he was explicit about it. You know, that we will be judged by Australia test matches. This is, I think it's in part a consequence of the time, really. It was interesting when we were doing a show a few weeks ago, when you were saying, when you were growing up, it was the West Indies that you'd mark yourself against.
But that hasn't changed. That's never changed. You know, people's jobs are always on the line every time an Ashes series comes around. That hasn't changed. What has changed, as far as I can tell, is that you would dismiss test matches at home. Now don't forget, even with the advent of satellite television, the fact that you can now watch test match series abroad, which prior to 1990 you couldn't do, right? Even with the advent of package tours and people being able to travel in their thousands to go and watch an Ashes series, okay, which probably won't be happening this time, there is still a fraction of the amount of people that are able to watch these games live or be interested in staying up until 6 o'clock in the morning to watch these games than there are watching the test matches that happen at home. As a cricketing nation, your home series is your shop window. It always is.
Sure.
Doesn't matter who it's against.
Sure.
Because you know what it's like. we work on the cricket, okay? So if we're at home and we're not in Australia, if we're not lucky enough to be out there, you're kind of obliged to sit up and watch it. Mm-hmm. But if you're a fan, England lose the toss at Brisbane or whatever, and you know, or win the toss at Brisbane and do the wrong thing. England 7 down by bloody midnight, everyone goes to bed. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, mm-hmm. it's not something that's that keeps people captured. Yep. In terms of their interest, if England start to do badly on an Aussie tour, because it's miles away and it's at the wrong time of night.
Sure.
But when you're playing at home, you're in front of everybody. This is the audience.
Mm-hmm. I get that. But the Ashes is 50%, one country and 50% the other. And I think that the overall mood around it applies even in the English summer as well. It is disproportionately covered and disproportionately respected. But then I also happen to feel that the way that people attach themselves to it in terms of sporting allegiance and the jeopardy of winning and losing and how that affects your mood that night, the morning after. I think English cricket fans, the majority of them, they always want the England side to win. But if the West Indies do them by 4 wickets as they did at Southampton last year, or if Pakistan turn them over in a great test match, a ding-dong test match, then I think a large number of England fans are okay with that. I don't think they wake up the following morning and their coffee tastes off. But when you get beat by Australia, we can't deny it, can we?
No,
we
but
can't
don't,
deny it.
But don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that it isn't important. All I'm saying is that it's not important to the absolute exclusion of biffing off your home test match series. That's what I'm saying.
And in that, we are in sweet agreement.
Right, there we go. So stop arguing with
onto the squad itself. As I said, two new faces, one of whom is Ollie Robinson. Joe, you spoke to his Sussex skipper, Ben Brown, yesterday. Let us know what should we expect from Ollie Robinson. His numbers are truly absurd.
Yeah, they're a joke.
He averages 17.68 in the last 5 seasons, in which he's taken 217 wickets, which is decent.
Yeah, you can see why he's picked. Yeah. Certainly. I spoke to Ben Brown. Actually, I was speaking to him about Sussex's youth policy, and then those kind of journalistic instincts kicked in. I thought, well, maybe I should ask the captain and wicketkeeper at Sussex about Ollie Robinson, England's next Test debutant. And he was interesting. I've got a few quotes here. He said he's the best red ball bowler I've kept to in a very, very long time. He said Steve McGoffin was probably the best in terms of skills. But Ollie Robinson's right up there. And obviously he's kept wickets to Jofra Archer in that time, which is interesting. It's the kind of classic cliche, but he said over the last couple of years, he has put on that extra yard of pace to go with the bounce that he's always got and the skills that he's always had. He said also that a lot of people might not know or kind of expect this of him, but he does incredible amounts of research into the batsmen he's up against in county cricket. He knows all their techniques, all their weaknesses.
And conclusion, hit the top of off.
but none of them like that.
But he's also
not one.
But he's also building a reputation as someone who can get good batsmen out on flat wickets, which is obviously helpful.
Well, this is it. And I think we saw that he did very well for the Lions in Australia, which certainly kind of boosted his reputation. Ben Brown said batsmen at whatever level aren't going to enjoy facing him. He's not rapid. He said 82, 84, maybe around kind of Stuart Broad's pace. But that height and those skills and that consistency, he thinks are going to cause problems for any batsman he comes up against in pretty much any conditions. Look, Ben Brown's not going to say anything but that, I guess, at this stage. But the stats do support that. And as much as we can lament the fact that England haven't just picked their best side for this series, and I think we're all in agreement on that, it has provided opportunities. And you could argue that Ollie Robinson, even if you are picking your best side, Ollie Robinson deserves a shot anyway. It is tricky because there are so many pace bowlers.
Best side isn't available. Not picking. Best side's not available.
Yeah.
Phil, England normally have millions of all-rounders. They normally have too many of them, but Stokes injured, Sam Curran, Chris Wokes, Moeen Ali all unavailable.
Are they?
They now don't have any all-rounders. England have not, they've opted not to choose an all-rounder from county cricket. So the balance of the side is going to be different. Mm-hmm. The last time England went into a test match without an all-rounder was...
Oh, don't put me on the spot. I can't remember what happened yesterday.
Brisbane 2013. So the test before Ben Stokes' debut, one after Chris Wokes' debut.
I was even out for that one. I was actually there.
Should have got that one.
I did pick Stokes for the Brisbane game, incidentally. Yeah, it was laughed out of town. Anyway,
wonderful.
Let that one go, I reckon.
Anyway.
Sure. 8 years, but sure.
Anyway, how do you think England are going to get around their no all-rounder problem?
I think they might not play a spinner and just play 4 quicks and hope for the best, but that might be nonsense. I don't know. It's a tough call between Overton and Robinson. I think one of them will definitely play, possibly both, if they do go with four. There is a sameness, I suppose, to the attack. If you do play the two icons and then those two as well, there is a sort of fast, medium-y, right arm over element to it.
It's worked really well in Australia in the past.
Yeah, indeed. But, you know, they might prefer to go with a bit more pace, obviously. But it is tricky. You realise the power of Stokes when you try and arrange these pieces into a old school conventional setup: six batters, keeper, and then four bowlers.
And there's a risk.
Will Leach do much at Lord's first Test match of the series? Possibly not. It might depend on how the weather is for the next couple of weeks. It looks like it's going to be very rainy. So my instinct is that they might go in just with the four seamers and try and wangle a few out of Joe and Lawrence, who will probably play. I think that Bracey might not make the cut. He might be the batsman to miss out.
I'm pretty sure that's the case, isn't it?
You think they'll go with four?
No, on the batsman. I think Bracey is the spare batsman in that squad, unless Sibley's hand injury doesn't come good.
On the no spin option, it's something that Silver was done before in the second Test match in New Zealand, when he had Leach available, had Parkinson available.
They did it in the last Test match at the Wanderers in South Africa as well. Yeah. Played five quicks in that one.
So it's something that he's shown that he's willing to do in the past. Yeah. I think on Overton versus Robinson, just in the last year, Robinson's been closer to playing a Test match than Overton has. Robinson went to Asia. Nearly played a Test match last
Robinson
summer as well.
I think Robinson gets in if one of Anderson and Broad don't play. Otherwise, if you're gonna leave out a spinner, which I'm loath to do, but anyway, let's say that we do that. Then I would say it would be Anderson, Broad, neither of whom are going to want to not play on a green one at Lord's in June. And you know, they bloody well deserve to play. I mean, absolutely, they're the best we've got. And then I would go Overton to bat eight. And his bowling is equally miserly and good. It has been this summer. And as a batter, he's getting better all the time. So that will give England a little bit of depth. I know there was a question about England's sort of tail end returns, which have been pretty shocking of late. Although I would discount the runs that anybody scored in India this winter in the Test matches, if for that matter. So that's, what was that? What did I say there? Overton. That means Robinson misses out, and then it would be one of Stone and Wood. And you know what? I was so impressed with Ollie Stone in the Test match that he played in Chennai that I would give him another go.
It almost got forgotten,
so
didn't
impressed.
It? In the context of that series, how good he was.
I've seen Ollie Stone bowl a handful of times, I suppose, prior to that Test match.
That opening spell was something else.
You know, I thought, well, I mean, he's all right. I mean, he's got a bit of pace and whatever, but I kind of just didn't, I wasn't really seeing what other people were seeing. Anyway, that first Test in Chennai, it was the second test, wasn't it?
Yeah, second Test.
He bowled absolute gas and held as good a line and length as Anderson or Broad would have done.
I think
so. I'm kind of like, I was blown away. I thought, wow, that's really impressive. And so that would be my four.
Yeah, I agree with you on Stone. I think we've got a real tendency in England to overhype the pace that fast bowlers bowl. Anytime anyone, you know, breaches 87, we're like, oh, proper quick. But Stone was actually hitting like 93 in that Test match.
And hitting the top of off stump.
I personally would just go Wood by nose over Stone and just go Robinson by nose over Overton. But it's really close calls.
Yeah, I would probably go Stone over Wood, basically with the T20 World Cup in mind. I know it's a long way away, but I think Wood is so important to England's chance in that. And England, as we've talked about, have eight seabowling options.
One thing to sort of, it doesn't quite back up what you're saying, but it makes sense to me, is that England have kind of not fancied Mark Wood at home. And that might be harsh, but I think that they feel Red Bull wise that his particular brand of hurry up is not as effective at home when you need to be a little bit more laser like in terms of your line and length. I mean, away from home, I think he's bowled absolutely magnificently, and you wouldn't swap him.
There's also a lot of white ball cricket to come quite soon, and Joffre is not going to be part of that.
So I'd love to see Ollie Stone get a go at home in that, and you've got immense amounts of control around him as well. But anyway, that's just personal preference.
I think Archer's injury concerns. He's actually injured for the series. Right elbow is troubling him again, and that's been a problem for quite a long time. I think that just makes the Mark Wood T20 World Cup point even more important. On the question about lower order runs, we had a few questions on this. Cricviz analyst Ben Jones asked, is a lack of runs from England's tail a concern?
What's he asking for? He knows. It's Cricviz.
150 in Silverwood's time as coach and the bowlers pick for this series don't immediately suggest things will change. The one thing I would say on that is that Overton and Robinson both average well over 30 of the bat this year in the Championship.
Overton particularly can bat. He strummed the 70-odd last week and took a load of wickets. He's comfortably the top of the MVP PCA Player of the Year so far, albeit shortish time. Made a very good 49, I think it was, in Australia on those pitches as well, from, again, number 8 or 9. He can bat. He can bat. He looks to me like a decent number 8 at test level.
Whereas I think Robinson is a decent number 8 at county level and is probably one position too high at 8 in a test team at the moment, although Brown did say his batting's got a lot better over the last year. But if that comes down to it, that might get Overton in above Robinson if they are a bit worried about the batting, which would be legitimate looking at that tail.
Yeah, indeed. And it's also probably worth pointing out as well, it's likely, I think we're in agreement that Lawrence plays in the middle order, Pope will play in the middle order, and then Folks will probably almost certainly take the gloves unless they go left field and give the gloves to Bracey, which almost certainly isn't going to happen. That is a raw middle order. Root's at 4, and then after that, there are rookie test players, albeit some good ones, potentially, and in Pope's case, almost now. But I think you need runs in the bottom order, especially a lower order, especially against New Zealand, you know, at Lord's, because they will be swinging it all over the place.
Mm. Absolutely. We've had one or two questions about players left out of the squad. One question was, what exactly does Matt Parkinson have to do to get picked? Who wants to take that one?
Claxton. I don't think we expected him to play in this test match. I mean, first of all, I would say Leach was probably England's best player in that tour of India. So it would be harsh, I think, for Parkinson to leapfrog Leach, even though we have seen Parkinson doing some kind of otherworldly things on social media. Look, I'd love to see Parkinson get a test match this summer, but then we're just back to where we started. How, if you want to pick your best team every time, is he England's best spinner for a test team at the moment in these conditions? It's hard.
He might stand it, but if he continues doing what he's been doing, he stands half a chance of getting a gig in one or two of the test matches against India later in the summer. Yeah. England aren't going to play two spinners. He's not going to play as a lone spin bowler. And therefore, you know, we're probably not even going to play a spinner in this first test. So it's just pie in the sky. But rest assured, Lancashire fan, I'm sure you must be, that he's very much on the radar for sure. But it's just now is not the time.
And I think we've said before on the shows that you kind of really want him to have one, because he's not played that much first-class cricket despite being around a lot. He kind of had one season where he takes 50, 60 wickets behind him before he gets that first England test call.
And yep. I think perhaps more personally, I mean, different coloured ball, but I'd like to see him given a real proper run in the white ball stuff, which is coming up after this test series. Adam Rashid doesn't need to play every white ball game for England. We know he's probably the best leg spinner in the world. He's got a bit of a dodgy shoulder. You could even play potentially both of them if the conditions are right, but I think let's see plenty of Parkinson in the white ball. That'd be
fun, wouldn't it? I'd like that. Yeah.
Yeah, the Aussies did that last winter.
I echo that 100%. And also, we've got to bear in mind, we'd love to see him play a Red Bull test match, but it has to be on merit. And where do you get those merit marks when the Red Bull stuff is over in, 2 weeks? And then it's all white ball cricket. And then there is one round of games in early July, literally 1 week of four-day cricket in amongst all the rest of it. And then obviously your playoff stuff, your four games in September, which will be great for the top division. But by that point, we'll be, you know, knee-deep in an India test series. So how does Parkinson, if he's only playing white ball cricket, put himself in the shop window and so on? Well, the answer possibly is you play a few games for England. You play a few games for England and you bowl 10 over spells and you bowl 4 over spells in the short silly stuff and you see where you get to. And if you can show, as Adil did, Adil got a test nod because he was excellent over 10 over spells with the white ball in English conditions. You know, stuff Kohli famously that time, you know, clean bowled him and so on. That might be his only way through. And so I totally agree with Joe. Not only does his record stack up anyway with the white ball, but there is an additional point to be made there, that that might be the way to bed him into the whole setup.
Mm. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Oh, it's got to be the Bancroft nonsense, isn't it? Really? Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. All right.
It's all very serious, this.
Oh, no, indeed. Very
serious. Well, one of my questions was, actually, from Nick Scribbler, he asks, are you amused, disturbed, or bored with the latest Sandpaper
all
game
of
revival?
It. I was going to say, all of them. That's a great question, and the answer is all of it. Amused, primarily. Okay, here's the quote. So, as we know now, I think context, Guardian interview Donald McRae speaking to Bancroft in his Durham kit in the northeast, coming over here to play a bit of cricket. McRae, who's past master at what he does, he prodded him a bit more about Cape Town 2018, and Bancroft said, quote, and I got it here, yeah, look, all I wanted to do was to be responsible and accountable for my own actions and part. Yeah, obviously what I did benefits bowlers, and the awareness around that probably is self-explanatory. So it doesn't take a genius to unpick that rather mealy-mouthed sentence. He was clearly inferring that the bowlers of Cape Town were just as aware of what was going on. And the notion that it was just these three wrong-uns, these three bad apples, has been rather blown out of the water. It didn't require an enormous leap of faith for us to assume that this was the case. But Bancroft now seems to have rather rammed that home. And it amuses me that something, just as an aside really, it amuses me that something so commonplace, right, and so routine and long-standing a thing as scraping away at the ball surface and fiddling around with the seam a little bit to help bowlers on flat decks, and in this particular instance performed so comically badly, slapstick bad, should continue to resurface and tilt again this listing moral compass of not just of Australian cricket, but of Australian life. I mean, this is a matter of state. As soon as the PM waded in first time round, this has become, this goes right to the heart of Australian life. And it will not go away, will it? It's this extraordinary.
Well, not as long as Bancroft keeps giving interviews.
Yeah, and this likable fool guy fella, Bancroft, you know, and I do warm to him the more I hear him talk.
But when I first saw that quote come up on social media that morning, I wondered if this was kind of a calculated move from a frustrated guy who's fed up that he's taken the fall for it. But I think he's just kind of let it slip. He's been undone by the best in the business. Don McRae's absolutely brilliant. And not in a cynical way. He's just very good at getting people to tell him stuff that they wouldn't necessarily tell them. I mean, that's what a great interviewer does. We might have managed to do it ourselves on one or two occasions over the years. But he does it every time. And Bancroft was kind of no match for him. But he should just keep his head down. I mean, he wrote that letter to himself, which he then decided to publish in the Aussie press. Like, I mean, write a letter to yourself, but keep it to yourself. Then he invited Getty photographers to come along and take photos of him doing yoga to show how much it kind of his new life. Now he's doing interviews with the biggest interviewer in broadsheet journalism in this country. Just keep your head down, score some runs. And unless he wanted to go out with this and make it public and say it's not fair that I take all the blame, I think that would probably be a fair enough thing to do. But I don't get the impression that's what's happened here.
If you are Bancroft, though, and that is what happened, you would be very frustrated that a number of people who were potentially involved kind of got away with it. It's worth saying the bowlers have issued a statement saying they knew absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Which is nonsense.
Of course. But
which is not... Everybody... See, the thing is, this whole thing was actually put to bed by anybody, you know, anybody. The only reason that you would ever bring it up is to take the mickey out of Australia when they come over. The crowds will be singing songs out and stuff. The only reason that this keeps resurfacing is because it was so comically handled at the time. There was this moral indignation that saw players getting banned for a whole year and people crying on national television and all this crap. The very idea that the team and the bowlers, that nobody else had any idea that this had happened, that it had never happened before, and that it was just an idea that popped up this afternoon, that suddenly three people had some idea about and nobody else had. Everybody knew that was nonsense. Everybody knew it was nonsense that Steve Smith did not play international cricket for an entire year for something like this, when the sanction for a discretion such as that was a three-match ban. You know, the whole, and this is all Australia's fault, their sort of superiority in terms of the morals, their moral code, which is much more superior to anybody else's when it comes to anything to do with anything, is the reason why that they're in the state that they're in. And that's the reason why people are so gleeful whenever stuff like this comes up. We're all happy to let it go. Who cares? But this is just too funny, too hilarious, too brilliant, and they're in the stew all over again. Superb. Great moment of the week.
Just the extra element, the grandees, the fading grandees, Gilchrist, Clark, etc., they all weighed in as well, saying it's implausible that the bowlers didn't know. And then it's all rounded off with Tim Payne having to give another somber interview, this time from, I think, his home in Hobart, saying it's just time, we're all looking forward to moving on. And I just the perfect line to sum up this thing, because it will never die, will it? They will keep regurgitating it, you know. Good luck with that one, champ.
What one thing? They'd all just held their hands up at the time and gone.
I know.
Yeah.
But I guess that's...
Balls caught, rumbled.
But that is basically what the main issue is. It's not that they tampered the ball. It is that they then lied about it. That was basically why they got a ban as long as it was. And you said something
in certain people's minds, but not, say, in the Prime Minister's mind.
Yes.
And in many of the editorials around Australia at the time, it was seen to be cheating.
This is true.
Didn't our PM get involved in that as well?
Yes,
Theresa May have something to say about it.
The stuff
that they find time to worry about. But the whole point about it is that every team tries to find some sort of an edge to make the ball do something when nothing's happening. Every single team does. And in order for a team to be successful at that on any level, at any grade, people have to know it's happening. You have to know. The bowlers have to know. Everybody has to know. Because if you don't, you can blow your cover inadvertently. And also, you then can't take advantage of the advantage that you're trying to gain. Because somebody will put their hands on it. Or something will go wrong in order to rubbish the thing that you've been doing to try to gain the advantage in the first place. It is utterly ludicrous that the people who are charged with running up and propelling the missile had no idea what was happening to the missile. It's complete and utter rubbish.
Like, I mean, Truscothick obviously came out after and spoke about in his book using Murray mints in the 05 Ashes. That wasn't just Truscothick with some sweets in his pocket doing that all by himself. Obviously, the team needed to know that. Otherwise, there's no point in Trez having his Murray mints.
Yeah.
I don't know if this stays in or not, but England's one-day team from a while back, there was one particular person that the ball always went through before it ended up back at the bowler. And that happened for a number of months, years.
And even if there is nothing untoward about untoward going on with the person who is getting the ball, the rest of the team has to know to give it to him, right? So you have to know something. You have to. Otherwise, you wouldn't throw it to him, would you? If nobody was in the loop, you'd be throwing it everywhere but the bloke who needed to get the ball. I mean, it's hilarious.
It's going to keep coming up every and now and again, though.
Every time anyone's got a book to release.
Exactly, that's going to be it, isn't it? When the first one retires.
And they'll be falling over themselves to tell the real story as well. I think we're going to have a kind of glut of these in a few years' time.
I think it was Daniel Brettig, the excellent Australian writer on Cricket Info, who proposed a kind of, like an amnesty almost, like kind of opening the question up and bringing about a kind of international kind of collective position on this, because it is the biggest open secret in the game, and maybe he's saying this because he knows some Australian players closely, but I can understand where he's coming from on that, because it becomes ever more ludicrous that we have to persist in this notion that the game is whiter than white, and this is a low grade thing, and you know, deep skullduggery. Well, if it is, then it's pretty regular stuff.
Anyway, Butch, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is Stuart Broad digging out departed chief selector Ed Smith, saying something along the lines of the communication was awful, and that whilst Ed Smith was particularly successful, or overall had a successful tenure as chief selector, I think the quote was something along the lines of, "Well, every employee has that boss that doesn't rate them, and Ed Smith was clearly mine." So lots of sort of veiled, not threats, but sort of inferences about the reasons why he and Ed Smith didn't get on particularly well, going back obviously to, what was it, 2019, the first test in Barbados where he was left out there. He felt that was down to Smith. Also getting left out again against the West Indies at the Aegeus Bowl last summer, for which he famously ranted in the diary room, didn't he, on Sky, which was great telly. But I think, interesting interestingly, we've sort of spoken about this over the last couple of weeks. And interestingly, I think Stuart Broad rather, if you read between the lines of the piece, I think it was Crick Info, wasn't it? But the interview came out on. He's letting you know that the players have kind of decided that they didn't fancy Smith very much. And that might be as much as anything the reason why he doesn't have the job anymore. Again, why the job itself has disappeared, I don't know. But, you know, the players have ended up getting their way, I think.
I thought what was interesting is Broad referenced two instances where he was left out the 11, not a squad. And I thought that the selector picked the squad and then captain coach picked the 11. Is that wrong?
Well, no, but I think this is it's open to interpretation, and that was interesting because Broad has deliberately let the cat out of the bag there that Smith made those calls. It was a classic Broad tour de force because everything was very in theory kind of considered and measured and reasonable, but under it you've got all this stuff that the line I think we see cricket very differently. So I, Stuart Broad with 500 Test wickets, see cricket very differently to Ed Smith with 3 Test caps. It's like it's brilliantly done, and it's hugely enjoyable. I think we'll see a few more because he's obviously off the leash now. What he's got nothing to lose. He's in the twilight of his career, and he's going to say it how he sees it.
Butch, what are you getting your dad for Father's Day?
What? Lovely question.
Now it's probably. I hadn't even thought. When does that happen?
In about a month's time.
Oh, well, there you go.
And we've got...
Maybe some sort of subscription to a great magazine.
Well, we'll get to the magazine later. But if you're, you know, like Butch, you're not sure what to get your dad for Father's Day.
Seamless segue there.
At the moment, we've got the best destination for dads who love cricket. As we mentioned before on the show, we've recently launched the Wisden shop, which you can find at wisden.com/shop. There's loads in there. We've got these beautiful prints of some of the UK's most loved cricket grounds. We've got film posters commemorating
over my shoulder, if you're on YouTube.
Yes, the two Headingley miracles, the mind the windows moment. We've got hoodies, umbrellas, books, drinks, absolutely loads. We're running a competition in the run-up to Father's Day, which is fast approaching, where we've asked our social media followers to tell us why their dad is the best cricket dad in the UK in 240 characters or fewer.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, we'll share a link to the original post in the reply to the tweet of this podcast for you to enter. The winner gets a £100 voucher in our shop. So head to the shop, head to our...
Have you still got the ale and the rye whiskey and stuff? So, I mean, it's not just mugs and you know, stuff for the wall. There's proper imbibing stuff. Yeah. There's proper stuff for dads.
Anyway, the county championship. Hey. There were a couple of really good final day wins for Essex and Durham, both battling not just their opposition, but the impending rainfall. This guy called Simon Harmer took 9 for 80. Dan Lawrence hit an unbeaten 150, which included some amazing shots. That was against Derbyshire. Durham beat Worcestershire, the first time Worcestershire haven't drawn a game in 2021. Chris Rushworth, this is my moment of the week, by the way, he took 9 wickets in the game, which means he is now the man with more first-class wickets for Durham than anyone else, overtaking his former opening bowling partner, Graham Onions. I really liked it because it was really clear how much it meant to him. He got very emotional, not just when he took the wicket to break the record, but also after the game where he embraced his dad who was watching. And it's just nice to see how much it meant to him. It's a great story too, released in the county at 19, didn't break into the first class side until he's 23, and for the last 10 years or so, he's been one of the most prolific wicket takers in the country. So that was lovely. Hampshire beat Middlesex in a low-scoring game at Lords, and rain around the country meant there were draws between Surrey and Somerset, Kent and Sussex, and Glamorgan and Yorkshire. That last game, by the way, was on Sky, and I really enjoyed watching Kieran Carlson bat, who turned 23 this week, and he's got more half centuries than anyone else this season. He looked really, really good, and he's an interesting story. He scored a first class 100 when he was 18. He had a good blast season when he was 19 or 20, but really struggled over the last couple of seasons, and he looks brilliant on a pitch that was doing a lot. It was seeming a lot against a really good Yorkshire attack. No one with express pace, granted, but lots of bowlers who basically hoover up in county cricket, and he looked really good. I think he scored a unbeaten 88 off about 80 balls. When
is he a Glamorgan boy?
Yeah.
He went to the same impish school as Gareth Bale and Sam Warburton. I'm pretty sure I'm saying. I can't remember the name of the school. Would be more impressed if I could. But you can look
still,
that one up.
Yeah. He's one to keep an eye out on. Elsewhere in the county game, Harry Gurney announced his retirement from the game this week at the age of 34, owing to a shoulder injury. He hasn't played any form of cricket since December 2019. one of the best white ball bowlers in the country. Gurney made 12 appearances for England all in 2014 and played in leagues all over the world, including the IPL. Yeah, just a brilliant white ball
top
bowler.
Top man, Hazard as well. Really good fella. And obviously, he's got the hospitality and pub business and whatever. So, wish him well when all that stuff opens back up again. But top lad, Harry Gurney.
Absolutely.
Really good.
Absolutely. And some news about the 100. A host of overseas players are expected to withdraw from the competition this year due to clashes with the international calendar and complications around travel because of COVID restrictions. 7 Australian men's players have already been named in a squad that clashes with a lot of the tournament. The participation of Pakistani and West Indian players is also in doubt. In the women's competition, Rachel Haynes and Jess Johnson have already pulled out of the women's competition.
Jinxed.
I can't remember who it was, but someone on Twitter had a look at how many of the overseas players could be missing, and it's possible that half of the players in the men's competition don't.
So, does that mean that they're going to sort of go back into the draft and try and find what's left, or are certain English players who have found themselves playing the dinky do nonsense laundromat tournament going to find themselves getting 100 gig?
I think they'll be looking to replace those overseas players. There are still a few countries where their players will be available. The complication is COVID stuff, is quarantine, etc. How much notice do those people need before they come into the country?
Absolutely.
And then we've got another question on the 100, actually. Jamie Burkamp asks, with team-specific DJs announced for the 100, how furious is Butch at not getting the call to be the Oval Invincibles house band?
Yeah, I mean, quite a good gig, actually. Some of these new stands and stuff. I don't know if I'd be able to fit it in.
Mm.
We're all, having to do this, for example. Takes up so much, of my time.
Elsewhere, Cricket South Africa have announced that AB de Villiers will not come out of international retirement this year ahead of the T20 World Cup. Their statement read, discussions with AB de Villiers have concluded, with the batsman deciding once and for all that his retirement will remain final, which is quite a dramatic wording, I thought. That's a great shame. 37 years old, but he's still tearing it up in the IPL. His IPL record in recent years is still ridiculous. Averages over 40, strike rate of about 150. Yeah, obviously, not only a loss for South Africa, but the tournament. And ESPN Cricinfo are reporting that India women's tour of Australia later this year will include a test match, which will be their first test match down under since 2006. Joe, there's a new magazine out this week. What's in it?
Yes, well, the cover feature is, we've referred to it in the last couple of shows. It is 30 years since Graham Gooch's masterpiece against West Indies at Headingley. So we use this as the basis to speak to 10 of England's greatest run makers, including Gooch himself, about the time they batted better than any other. So that's not necessarily just their famous Ashes 100, although it could be. This is the time where it all clicked into place. Each of these batsmen has talked us through that innings, given the backstory, how it was possible. Some came from nowhere, some had quite a long build-up. So we've spoken to people like David Gower, Alan Lamb, Charlotte Edwards, Heather Knight. Help me out, Phil.
We tried to speak to him, but he wasn't asked. Actually, he does
that's
have something
true.
Else.
That's exactly what I said.
he does have something else in the magazine.
Robin Smith. There's some great stories in there. I mean, I spoke to David Gower for his...
Which is the winner, I think.
What innings did Gower pick?
So Gower refers back to the tour that we talked about, Gooch referred to, in when Canning Barrington very sadly died in the middle of that tour.
81 series, yeah?
Yeah, 81. Yeah. And Gower had basically felt he was in very good nick against a good attack, but had got lots of starts, but hadn't got a big score. It came to the final test at Jamaica, and he was really pissed off of himself. He'd got out to Viv when he was on 40-odd earlier in the test series. So he said this was the only innings where he actually physically talked to himself through the innings to actually get himself to focus. I mean, it's kind of... This was a dead rubber.
It's so Gower, isn't it?
Oh, come on, dear boy.
Come on, Dave.
I thought it was quite interesting. A lot of these England batsmen pick out centuries in games where they lost, which you might say is just because England lost quite test matches. But this is quite interesting because it is a dead rubber, essentially. But for Gower, he describes it as a moment of personal triumph in a tour where he really should have done better. But I thought my favourite quote of it when he was referring to kind of talking himself through the innings and his determination to stick around was, you could argue this should have been my approach for the other 200 plus innings I played in Test cricket. We didn't quite get the same care and attention.
There is a parallel though, with Heather Knight and Charlotte Edwards both picked innings where they did something unusual, where they played outside of themselves a little bit. And Gower's innings bucks the cliche, inverts the cliche of how he yep. played. And it's the same with Heather and with Charlotte as well. And it's interesting when you go to these individuals and it's these innings where they surprise themselves that I think stay with them more pertinently than others.
You know, Mark Ramakrish is interesting as well.
He picked out
Middlesex under-25s against Leicestershire under-25s from 1987 when he was still a teenager. He scored 152 in no time at all. But his was all about going out there as a young player, having no fear, no inhibitions, and just playing on instinct. Mm. And he talks about...
Cap on, no helmet.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talks about how, over the course of his career, those inhibitions start to affect the way you play. Mm. Obviously, in county cricket, it didn't stop him scoring a heap of runs. But given what we know about Ramps's Test career as well, it felt very poignant that he picked out this innings where he just let it flow. He just could be himself. And we know that very rarely happened for England, unfortunately. And he only really, I think he said, kind of discovered that later in his career, post Strictly, when he just scored mountains of runs for Surrey.
Kept year averaging after 100.
Year. Yeah.
Averaged over 100 twice in a full now, first class season.
This Gower thing is really, really interesting to me. I mean, I interviewed David, but I mean, obviously, my absolute hero as a kid growing up. Interviewed him at Lord's and I rebuked him a little bit for kind of like for continuing the myth of, you know, the champagne swilling, not really all that bothered, sort of, you know, upper class Lord cricketer type thing. And saying, well, you must have, you know, come on, you didn't score that many runs without actually doing a little bit of practice, without caring a little bit, you know, type of thing. And he wouldn't be drawn on that. But the interesting thing about what he's saying there is that, I don't know, there's this sort of classism thing that goes right. We're sort of looking at the history of all sorts of things at the moment in terms of class and in terms of where cricket started and how the game came up as, you know, landowners, etc., would be the batsmen and the blokes working on the farms would be the bowlers type thing. And this idea that's perpetuated, particularly in England, that it's not cool to kind of look like you're that bothered. You know, the idea that you would actually practice, and this goes into the workplace as well, you know, in the city or whatever, you know, the idea that you would actually look as though that this thing was causing you some sort of mental torpor is absolutely a no-no. And that is the essence of Gower, really, isn't it? He kind of made everybody, the club players, the kids at school or whatever, you would all wander out there like you did not give a crap. And it was kind of, that's kind of English sport. In many ways, particularly cricket, the Gooches and stuff are complete and utter outliers, guys who would sweat and toil and be, you know, desperate for every single run and make it look like they were hungry. Everybody else is trying to look like they do not care. And that's partly David Gower's fault. And wonderful that he admits it in print. Good.
Just on Ramprakash, I remember, Phil, when you were on the BBC radio stream for the Surrey game, you were talking about Ramprakash with Mark Church. I looked up some stats that day, and in an eight-season period between 2003 and 2010, Ramprakash averaged 78 in first-class cricket, 13,000 runs, 53 hundreds in an 80-year period.
When did he play his last test, 2002?
One or two.
He played 0-1 because he got 100 here, didn't he?
He was on the New Zealand tour 2002, Ben Holyoake tour.
That's right.
So that might have been his last test. So from that moment onwards, and then post Strictly, which is what, 2007.
Yeah, they should have a filter in Stats Guru post Strictly.
It applied to a few. Yeah.
I remember batting with him in that period of time, and just thinking, I've never seen anything like this. You know, obviously, just there was an inevitability about the runs that he was going to make. And sometimes he'd make them in a really sort of carefree and aggressive fashion as well. It wasn't simply, I'm going to go out there, get my head down and grind them out. Sometimes he'd obliterate attacks as well while he was doing it. It was just batting on another plane. Now, in that period of time, I was doing all right. So I was playing pretty well, as well as I think I ever did as a county player in terms of consistency and whatever. Couldn't touch him, couldn't lace his boots. What, extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
Why one day would he go out there and blaze away and another day?
I don't know. You'd have to ask him.
Yeah.
Because there's just no... You couldn't ever fathom Mark Ramprakash on the cricket field. Right. You know, some days he'd be, you know, very, very... Some days he'd be worried about the bowlers that he was going to be facing on a day. Outwardly sort of like worried and nervous. And then he'd walk out and hit his first ball back over the bowlers ever six type thing. He'd be like... don't know what is happening here.
Matt Thacker picked up on... Matt Thacker's worked at the Oval for 100 years and he watched a lot of Ramps and he picked up something that Ramprakash used to do to the one over of spin before lunch thing. Ramprakash would go out there and run down the pitch invariably and slap him somewhere. And Matt observed this over a period of years and sort of asked him about it. He said, "Don't you dare tell anybody. Don't you dare. It's one of my secrets." How do you know? How do you bloody know? Probably didn't talk to him for another 2 years.
Just the paranoia, you see.
Yeah.
Just the beauty of Rams. But man, he was good.
Yeah. Joe, the County Files has been a great addition to the magazine in recent editions. Another great one here. I picked out two of my favourites. One of them was definitely written by you, Tilan Wilalawita, who is a young spinner at Middlesex.
Yeah, I spoke to him a month or so ago, actually, and he'd just got injured. He had a hamstring injury at the start of the season, so I was really pleased to see him on the telly making his championship debut against Gloucestershire. He was one of the kids that got a chance in the Bob Willis Trophy last year, probably wouldn't have played last year if it wasn't for the fact that others weren't available. Did really well, bowled very tidily. Middlesex think a lot of him. He came over from Sri Lanka as, kind of, I think, 11 or 12 years old. And he actually hasn't got his visa yet, so he's technically playing as an overseas player for Middlesex, but they think that'll all be sorted soon and he can play as a UK qualifier player. But he's got an interesting backstory in that he was caught up in the Boxing Day tsunami. Him and his family literally fled as the waves were getting higher and higher. They were having a cup of tea in a cafe and his dad heard some noises outside, went out the front and saw these waves building and said, "We've got to get out of here." And they literally ran, left their car, came back the next day and there were bodies and rubbish everywhere. I mean, it was kind of a traumatic experience for a young kid. Then he moved over to England 5 or 6 years later. His dad played club cricket over here and he quickly got picked up by Middlesex and he's been with them ever since. So it's an amazing story and they think a lot of him. And he was lovely, lovely bloke to speak to. So I wish him all the best and hopefully get a few more chances this year.
Absolutely. So there's a little story on each of the 18 counties. Phil, you did one of those. You did one on Essex and you were in the other room whilst you conducted this interview with Sam Cook and it just sounded really fun.
Yeah, it was. He's a lovely lad, articulate boy. He's also from my hometown as well. He went to the Rough House School around the corner from mine, actually, although he insists it wasn't rough when he was there. And it was a conventional chat, although a sparky one, and then turned out that he's a DJ. He's a house and drum and bass DJ. And suddenly the conversation took on a wholly more interesting bent.
You love it when you don't have to talk about cricket in your cricket interviews, don't you? Basically,
yes,
that's your favourite bit.
Yes, please. And he doesn't make money from it just yet, but he turns the tables on whenever he gets going and of an evening and... he's looking at a potential second career once he's done in that world. He's also a damn fine bowler. I'm not sure if he's quite got the mythic extra yard that you need for the top level, but he's going to take a lot of county wickets at the very least.
He already has, and he's 23, maybe just 24, and he's already been part of three either county championship or Bob Willis first class competition wins for Essex. And he's really good, I think.
And as I think Phil pointed out in the piece, he's almost kind of usurped Jamie Porter over the last year or so as their kind of go-to seamer. Porter's record has tailed off a little bit, still very impressive, whereas Cook's is right up there. I mean, I think his average is even better because he played a bit of universities cricket, I think, and didn't average particularly well in that. His Essex average alone is absolutely superb.
Yeah, I think he's a more probing bowler on flat wickets, which, you know, even though he doesn't bowl that quickly, that might be counterintuitive. But I don't think he relies that much on movement in the air. I think he gets a lot of movement off the pitch. I think he's a really, really good bowler.
Indeed.
Joe, what else is in the magazine?
Well, we've got the Chris Wokes interview that Phil did with Wokes in his IPL bubble, followed by quite a few text messages and another chat. Did you speak to him again? Or you were just...
Yeah.
So I think that was quite a long drawn out interview.
It was like a counselling session by the end of it.
Yeah. But no, it's come out really nicely. And Wokes is...
Oh, thank you, Joe.
He's an absolute... I obviously wouldn't say it to your actual face. No, I only say it on the podcast.
Sure.
But Wokes is obviously a smashing bloke. Phil's got good rapport with him. Obviously had to bring up his snooker game from actually have to
kicked it off, didn't I? Kicked it off.
You did.
With the story of my snooker game with him about you also, seven, eight years ago.
The way you talked about that you could just see Wokes playing snooker and just understand immediately that he's an elite sportsman, and then you mentioned that he only just nicked it on the pink well, to beat you. As though two elite sportsmen up against each other.
Fighting, duking it out.
I debated putting a line through that line. But we left it in.
We wouldn't have spoken for weeks if you'd done that.
And there's the columnists are in great form. Andrew Miller did a piece on the European Super League, saying he'd saw hallmarks of cricket in the botched proposal, referencing the 100 and the kind of disregarding of legacy fans, the reduction of the World Cup to 10 teams. And the big three, which we are told doesn't exist anymore, but does seem to. There are quite a lot of resemblances there, and Andrew Miller's expertly kind of picked them out. Lizzie Ammon says this is a chance for the T20 Blast to kind of reaffirm its status as a proper T20 competition in its own right. It's got a, albeit quite narrow window, but it is the only show in town for a while. It will be on telly. It's not all about the 100. And I think county fans are going to be getting behind it more vociferously than ever, particularly because the 100 is around the corner.
Yeah, and I think they have, interestingly, they have been the last two or three years anyway. Yeah. There's been a huge apparent uptake. I know that I've not done the stats on it, but I've worked on a lot of the games and the crowds seem to be building year on year. So I think you're right. I think there'll be a swing back. Because of the impending 100, and that there'll be plenty of people
the
coming.
The pre-sales this year have been great.
Yeah,
well.
Good.
Really, really good.
I'm pleased.
Just need this rain to stop in time, but hopefully it's getting it all out of its system.
Apparently
now.
It does. Apparently it does. Yeah. I saw a tweet this morning.
You are our resident meteorologist, aren't you?
Well, it is interesting. The weather recently has been really bad, and I wanted to see good news related to the weather. So I looked on Twitter, and apparently by the end of the month, it's going to be really good.
Lovely, well, there you
so
go.
You heard it here first. You heard it here first. And also, just going through the contents page, the my favourite spell will be of interest to Butch.
What was it?
Gary Butcher's 4-4.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I forgot. Sorry, this is the problem. It goes to print and it immediately leaves my head. So that was Matt Thacker, who Phil referred to before, who we should say he's our boss. He's the managing editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly. He was picking out his favourite spell. It's more indicative of... He was very much involved in Surrey at that time, doing the kind of the club magazine. And I think it's fair to say Surrey weren't universally loved on the county circuit. And the piece is really that Matt couldn't really understand why, other than the fact they won all the time, because he loved seeing this team, which was almost like a... He could describe it almost like a club side in some ways, and that they enjoyed each other's success. I think had a few drinks, possibly, off the pitch.
Never.
And this is, yeah, Gary Butcher, Mark's brother, who took four wickets in four balls against Derbyshire. As Matt points out, not the strongest four batsmen, I think he said.
I think Rob Bailey was one of them. In that, LBW.
I'm not sure in that four, because he took five in that inning. Oh, so maybe, I think that wasn't in
maybe
the,
that wasn't in the
in
four.
The four.
Maybe he opened the door with Rob Bailey and then knocked over the other.
I think Tim Munton was batting at nine. I think Matt said possibly four places too high. So that's nice. That's a nice one.
Excellent. As always, you can get the magazine at wisden.com/shop. That is all for today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Butch. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you've liked what you've listened to or watched, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and we'll be back next week. Cheers. Sports Social Podcast Network.